So a few years ago, I was in a waiting room, and I got a text message from somebody that I went to college with and hadn't really talked with that much, telling me that they were in a relationship and that he was sleeping with his girlfriend. And then he asked, "Am I under grace?" And I texted back, "Alex, we're all under grace, but I don't think that means what you think that means." And so he calls, and he starts talking to me, and I'm in a waiting room, and after a while, he's yelling at me. At one point, he yells at me, "A man's got needs, Jonathan." And I was like, "Alex, you called me? Like, I'm not chasing down everybody who's, like, doing stuff and being like, hey, let me tell you what you need to work on." I was like, "You called me. You want to know if Jesus is okay with this?" And so the answer is no, because I don't get to make this stuff up. And there's good reasons why Jesus says when your body does something, your soul makes promises. And it's true, empirically true. It's just true. This is Jesus' vision of reality, and we don't get to make it up. But I'm not trying to go around and like chase people down. I'm not trying to change the world. The job of the church is to be the church of Jesus Christ and show the world another way to live. And I want us to be a church for the world, not a worldly church. And I'm assuming that because you came to church this morning, or because you're maybe listening to the podcast, or maybe you're watching the live stream, you are interested in Jesus of Nazareth and what he has to say about reality. So I want you to see what the Christian vision of the body is. Because long before a body is biological, it is theological. I was actually doing a wedding yesterday, and on our way back, Leslie and I got behind a car, and there was a bumper sticker. It was one of those cars that was very opinionated, you know, like lots of bumper stickers. But one of those opinions were, the bumper sticker said, "Keep your theology off my biology." I was like, man, I have never seen such an appropriate bumper sticker for the sermon I'm preaching tomorrow. But the reason I bring that up is I didn't get out of the car and knock on their window and be like, "Let me tell you something, before your body's biological, it's actually theological." No, because our job is not to change the world. Our job is to be the church of Jesus Christ. And before your body is biological, it is theological. It tells a story, and Christians believe it tells a story of God. Have you ever considered how weird your body is? Like, I mean, think about it. Human beings, we just have weird bodies. We don't have, like, claws or fangs or awesome fur. No, we just have these, like, ungainly. We, you know, aren't great balance. We, you know, get pushed over really easily. And as human beings, the question is, why are we the way we are? Or the way that the Bible has been asking this for thousands of years is something like this. In Psalms 8, "What is man that you are mindful of him? And the son of man," who's like the representative of all humans, "that you care for him?" Later on in the Psalms, it's the same question. In Psalms 1, going to the next one. In Psalms 144, "O Lord, what is man that you regard him? Or the son of man that you think of him?" In other words, it's not just what are human beings, but how do human beings stand before God? Now, this is important to me because I am a human being. And I'm also raising human beings. So for the last year or so, I've asked our kids at different times, what's the difference between humans and animals? Because we got a lot of animals. We got dogs and cats and turtle and chickens and fish and all that stuff. And when you ask that question over and over again, they start to ask other questions back. Like, "Dad, will dogs go to heaven?" I'm like, "Yes, of course they'll go to heaven. God loves them. God cherishes them." "Well, won't cats go to heaven?" "No, they'll go to hell where they belong." That's good theology, right? So I do find it helpful when we start talking about what human beings are to go back to Genesis 1 and 2. Because a lot of us, if you grew up in church, you're familiar with Genesis, but you have no idea what's in there. I mean, it's amazing. Genesis 1 and 2 is full of nuance, and it's so great. It's so much to say about what human beings are. And the reason I care about Genesis 1 and 2 is because Jesus believed it. It was a vision of reality that Jesus shared and proclaimed. So Genesis 1 and 2, the difference between human beings and animals is in there. But first off, we have a lot more in common with them. Like in the very first verses, in the beginning God created. There is a line, creator and creation. And we must never forget we are on this side of that line. We are not creators. We do not get to create our own identity. We are made. Our lives, our bodies are received. And then Genesis, in Genesis, we don't even get our own day. Human beings are made with of all the other animals. Now, Genesis is telling a story where creation, the pinnacle of creation is God making Adam and Eve. We're at the pinnacle of this. And we're not just products of His activity, we're products of His intention. So, if you're like me, one of the first things you knew about Genesis is that it was arguing with Charles Darwin. My first ever speech that I ever gave was proving that Charles Darwin was wrong and Genesis was right, as if it was a scientific textbook. And I, by the way, I understand why. I understand why Christians have been so nervous about evolutionary theory for the last 100 years. It wasn't so much about what evolution was saying about the past. It was what people were trying to make evolution say about the future and the present. The philosophy of materialism or naturalism is actually the problem that you really have. I'm not smart enough to understand evolution, but godly people that I trust have told me, that this is probably something that happened. But there is no major scientific findings that are a threat to my Christian faith. Because Genesis isn't trying to do anything like what Charles Darwin did. It's a totally different kind of story. And the reason I want you to know that is because I want you to see this has something authoritative to say to our lives. So Genesis 1 is not God creating out of nothing. We find about that in John 1. But in Genesis 1, it's a different story. There's something already there. So I want to teach you a Hebrew word. Here, read this with me. Just kidding. I'll tell you how to say it, though. It's tohu va bohu, okay? Let's all say it. Tohu va bohu. Now, that word is translated formless and empty. It's not translated formless. It's something that's present, but doesn't have shape. So the first readers of this would know it's God bringing order to chaos. The first readers who first read Genesis 1 would know it immediately. It's a temple story. The seven days, it's a temple story. The audience of Genesis is Israel, not Adam and Eve. Moses is preaching to Israel. Think about this. Moses, right before the tabernacle is inaugurated, Moses sits down with the elders of Israel and says, once upon a time, the whole world was sacred space. The whole world was filled with the presence of God. But humans rebelled and went their own way. And now, God is going to, for the first time since the beginning, inaugurate a sacred space again. Now, what's so great about Genesis 1 is there's all kinds of different stories of creation out there in the ancient world. And you can go look at them. If you're a doubter or a skeptic or a non-Christian and you're a little skeptical, go check those out. Because Genesis 1 and 2 is different than all the rest of them. The other ones are called theomachies, which is a word that means gods at war. And basically the way that the ancient world said that human beings came about was that gods were fighting and one god cut another god in half and that body decayed and became earth. And the gods made some people in their image, but it was all the rulers, all the pharaohs, all the important people. And the reason God made human beings, the reason all these different gods made human beings is because they didn't want to work. So they made them as slaves. But the most offensive part of Genesis 1 and 2 in the ancient world would have been its atheism. That's right. Because in the beginning, one God. In fact, the famous atheist Richard Dawkins makes this point often. He says, a lot of people, everybody doesn't believe in gods. I just believe in one less God than you do. Well, Richard Dawkins got that possibility from Genesis. Because in the ancient world, when Genesis was written, they worshipped the sun and the moon and the stars. And here, like a freight train into the ancient world, comes Genesis 1 and 2 that says, that's not God. That's not God. That's not God. There is only one God, and He made all things. And all people are made in His image. Now, this is revolutionary. The idea that everyone is made in His image. The rabbi of London, who recently passed, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, said this in one of his books. In the ancient world, it was rulers, emperors, and pharaohs who were held to be in the image of God. So what Genesis was saying is that we're all royalty. That's exactly what they would have got. Picture Moses sitting down with Israel the night before the tabernacle and saying, "Hey, you were just in slavery. Lift up your head, daughters of Eve. Lift up your head, sons of Adam. You are full image bearers of God. You are not slaves. You reflect God." Now, why am I telling you all this? When Adam, the word Adam means human. The word Eve means life. And the first readers were knowing that this was making a claim that all human beings image God. Now, Hebrew language doesn't exist until the second millennium, which means their names weren't Adam and Eve. This is not historical reporting. This is talking to Israel. This is the story of the first man and the first woman and how the world was made for them to image God and rule with God and how they messed this all up. Okay, why am I telling you all this? Because our view of the body that we will build on for the next few weeks depends on can you trust this story or not? And what the implications are. Do I receive my body and my life as a gift from God with gratitude? Or do we see it as a set of negative limitations that we must conquer? So let me say it like this. This is a picture of the Hubble telescope, the picture taken by the Hubble telescope. When it was first taken, it was one of the most breathtaking, it was the furthest glimpse we had into the starlit sky. And you could see all the amazing insights that we were able to get with the Hubble telescope. But this is a very different picture of something quite like it. Vincent van Gogh's A Starry Night. Now, I'm not an art expert, but people who are say something profound is happening in this picture. That the colors that he uses, it's telling a story that Vincent van Gogh looked up and said and created a very profound truth. And the reason I'm showing you this is because for the last few hundred years, our world has been all Hubble telescope and no starry night. The way Genesis 1 and 2 is written is much more like van Gogh's work than it is Hubble telescope. And the reason I want you to see that is because Jesus is going to appeal to Genesis 1 and 2. And he's not arguing with science. He's having an assumption about what human beings are and why that matters. And Genesis 1 and 2 has something authoritative to say about ultimate reality, what it means to be human, and how to live a meaningful life. We tried to make this science because for the last few hundred years, we thought that the only thing to know anything really was scientific. But is that leading us to joy and flourishing? Let me show you a quote from one of the first people who went down this path. "Up to the age of 30 or beyond it, poetry of many kinds gave me great pleasure. And even as a schoolboy, I took intense delight in Shakespeare. Formerly, pictures gave me considerable delight, and music, very great delight. But now, for many years, I cannot endure to read a lot of poetry. I have tried to read Shakespeare and found it so intolerably dull that it nauseated me. I've also lost any taste for pictures or music. I retain some taste for fine scenery, but it does not cause me the exquisite delight which it formerly did. My mind seems to have become a machine for fringing general laws out of large collections of facts. The loss of these facets is a loss of happiness and may possibly be injurious to the intellect and more probably to the moral character by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature." Charles Darwin. This is ground zero of looking at reality, all Hubble telescope and no starry night. So does your wife love you? Scientifically? Does your husband love you? Do you love your kids? Do those friendships really matter? Do your job and life have meaning? So a couple weeks ago, we talked about how lonely and disconnected our modern world is. And that's because the Enlightenment solved a lot of problems while it created a lot more. And at the heart of all these problems is, what is a human body worth? Do our bodies matter? Do they have any significance? You know, we talk about progress a lot. The Holocaust was a version of progress. It was a vision of progress. And it was not done from religion. It was done with the incredible efficiency and desacralization of the human body. Race-based slavery was a vision of progress. It was a way of leveraging human bodies to do what the vision of economic progress at the time was. The sexual revolution is one version of progress. And the rise of violence and suicide and sexual promiscuity is connected to a vision and philosophy that say human bodies aren't worth much. One of the things that atheists, well-reasoned atheists, are almost universally united on admitting is that Christianity is the one who gave the world human rights. The idea that human beings are special in the universe or have any kind of separate moral dignity from animals or any other part of the world, that is squarely from Judaism and Christianity. And outside of it, it's just a superstition. Because there's a story that Jesus has captured the world with. And let me show you the story he believes. There's a time in the Gospel of Matthew where Jesus is cornered by some religious people, and they're wanting to draw him into the culture war of their day, specifically about divorce. Because there's, you know, liberal religion and conservative religion, and they have different, you know, debates about divorce. Can a man just divorce a woman for any reason, or does he have to have a good one? Is basically the thing. And by the way, women were incredibly vulnerable in this day, so divorce almost never went for them. It was never a good thing for them. So in Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees try to trap him. Matthew 19, the Pharisees come up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" And Jesus answered, "Have you not read?" I love this. These people have memorized Genesis. Jesus is such a like smart aleck ninja here. Do you guys, y'all know Genesis 1? "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." So they come up to him, and it's not an honest question. It's a religious gotcha question. If you grew up in a religious environment, you may have seen people try this before. You know, it's not, they're not asking for answers. They're trying to trap Jesus. And Jesus just sidesteps the thing by telling them a story. And this is what I love about Jesus. If you grew up in church, it might be confusing to you that sometimes Jesus goes around telling stories like a man was throwing out seeds. And after the story's over, the religious people are like, "We got to kill him." Like, why do you have to kill him for that? Because he's challenging their vision of ultimate reality with the story he's telling. And so when they come at him with a story about, you know, can a man, he tells them a story. He reminds them of a story. He starts with a story. And then it's a story that tells us anthropology, which is the study of human beings. What is a human being? What does a body mean? And then it goes to theology. And then he gives us the command. And this is important because I think often, you know, Christian churches, we just kind of talk about the commands. But why does Jesus say what he says? And the reason this matters is because all day long, all week long, you, your kids, your grandkids, the people that you care about, and specifically you are being formed by a secular story. It's in everything you watch, in the movies you watch, the TV, the news, the media, the music. And so I want to attempt to tell the secular story that you hear over and over. I want to do what Jesus does. I want to set the secular story by the Christian story. Okay, here it is. First off, the secular story. Number one, human beings are just animals. We're just primates. We're apes with time and chance on our side. Human nature is, it just is. There's no meaning or purpose to the human body, to gender or sexuality, other than the propagation of species. 3, male-female sex is just plumbing. 4, gender is just social construct. It's imaginary. It's often developed by the patriarchy to oppress women or older women to oppress younger women. 5, Sex is just play for grown-ups. It's just a biological release. That's all it is. Love is a feeling of happiness you get from being with another person, or a desire, probably a sexual desire for another person. Marriage is probably just a social construct from around the Byzantine era. Has to do a lot with tribal alliance, commerce, patriarchy, oppression of women, children, and monogamy is not natural. You don't really see a lot of it in nature. In fact, nature has designed the male, design's the wrong word. Nature has evolved that the male body is to try to get its sperm and as many women as possible, again, for the propagation of species. And the purpose of marriage, now that the earth is overpopulated and we know better than religion and tradition, is happiness, if marriage even has a purpose. And if you're into marriage, great. If it's same sex, different sex, many partners, whatever, you do you. And if you're not into marriage, don't worry. There's a lot of other options for your sexuality. Divorce, or as Gwyneth Paltrow recently put it, conscious uncoupling, is the enlightened decision for two people who have fallen out of love or no longer have a desire for each other or no longer are happy. And if you're not happy in a marriage as defined by you, then you need to get out of it. And if you have kids, that stinks, but man, they need to see you being true to yourself. What about the Bible? You know, Western civilization is built on it. Well, that's great. The Bible is a collection of human writings. It's got some great ideas, but it's also full of sexism and racism and patriarchal oppression and anti-erotic ideas. And any and all forms of external authority are oppressive if they're imposed on you, and repressive if they're held by you. So keep your laws, your rules, your ideas off my body. Politician, pastor, parent. Keep your theology off my biology. The overall meaning in life? Well, technically, if we're honest, there's not one. Life is a glorious or not so glorious accident, depending on how much money you have. There's no creator, which means there's no creation. It's just nature, and it's red and tooth and claw. So now that we have an earth that is full, feel free to come up with whatever meaning you can. Ideally, something that connects with progress, because that goes along with evolutionary theory. And we all want to believe, come on, hey, we're good people. We want to, you know, make the world better, but we don't want religion or God impeding our progress to a world where there's no racism, no sexism, where we upload to the cloud and live forever as Homo Deus. This idea of God is a dead weight holding us back from enlightenment now. And if you can't come up with a cause to give your life to, that's okay. We've got lots of prescription medicine, great food, lots of entertainment. Just hang out with your friends, enjoy your life, and swipe right while it lasts. Okay. So we don't normally hear that all at once. But that is, and I've run that by several of my secular friends, and this is the iceberg of which we hear the tip all the time. My friends would say, we wish you would use it more poetic language, like we're made from stardust or something like that. But this is it. This is the story that we're being formed by on a regular basis. So there's a kind of, you know, mantra or idea that's everywhere. And let me play a song for you that I recently ran across by Ian McConnell. It's called Important, and I think it sums up what I just said pretty well. I'm not singing this, guys.
I'm pretty sure that life doesn't have a meaning. And if there's a God, then he doesn't look like me. And I'm just a member of the current apex species. But there will be another when the humans go extinct. We've only been around 200,000 years of 13.5 billion years. How can we think the pinnacle is here? Isn't that arrogant? There's a couple hundred billion trillion suns, and we act like it all was made for us. There ain't no way that we're the only ones. I'm not important, and neither are you. So let's do whatever we wanna do. Bask in our cosmic insignificance. Soak up this blip we're living in, 'cause nothing matters anyway. Isn't that great?
So that is not an outlier. It's just direct. And the reason this is important is because this is in a thousand mini stories that we read and hear. Our hearts and our desires are being formed by this. Really. We don't pay attention to how much our practices, what we watch, what we pay attention to, forms us. It's in our sitcoms, our movies, a post on Instagram, almost everything on TikTok, our news stories, comments by a coworker. And so it's easy to assume it's reality. Is it? I would argue it's a story. This all is not original to me. I would argue that this is a story. A reading of the data points of science and religion and history. But is it the real story? Is it even a good story? We're 60 years into this and we're just now reaping some of the strongest consequences. Do we like where this world is headed? There's a Catholic feminist named Melinda Sims who has this quote, Melinda Selms, who has this quote, underneath the pop and fizzle of the sexual revolution, there's a lot of despair. If not about sex, then surely about the body. It seems counterintuitive. Surely the sexual revolution is about the celebration of the body over and against the pretext that love ends below the neck. Yet beneath all the pageantry of free sex and self-love, there is a fundamental belief that the body doesn't mean anything. It is literally insignificant. It signifies nothing. You can do anything you like with it. And then she gives some examples of what those things can be. But in order to do this, in order to believe that, here's what you have to believe. A, your body is not you. It's just a shell or a robot. The real you is that disembodied ghost that controls you. B, there's no such thing as human value or dignity. It's a nice pretense that we make because we're terrified of this senseless and nihilistic universe. Ironically, Christianity, which has always been accused of putting God before man, stands alone among a host of other modern philosophies declaring that man is a unified, complete being composed of the mind and the free will and the body, all of which has dignity and meaning. Now, why am I telling you this? We live in Little Rock. I do not think that the current secular sexual narrative has fully taken hold in Little Rock. And here's what that means, by the way. It means, because I have friends or pastors in Portland and L.A., and they tell me there's a loss of joy. I mean, it doesn't lead to human flourishing, but the PR for it is really great. So here's what that means, church. It means we have to take the way of Jesus really seriously. Guys, you might need to get in an accountability group. You might need to talk to somebody. Because this way is not good for the women in your life. It's not good for your own soul. If you're in the 20s and professionals, you need to fight against hookup culture in every way you can. If you don't know what hookup culture is, ask somebody from the tap. They can tell you. You're not going to like it. And if people who are sexual minorities, that we've got to be able to love people really well who are sexual minorities, because the bar of discipleship is high for everybody. Jesus asked everybody to pick up a cross. But for some people, that is an incredibly challenging time, especially when our churches seem oriented for families only. So we don't have to try to change everybody's behavior. We have to love them the way God loved them. And let God's kindness lead us to wholeness. But I told you all that because I think that's a story that we're being told right now. Is it the true story? Is there a better story? Here's what I think it is. The story of Christianity for 2,000 years has said not only is creation good because God made us, but God became one of us. So here's something I want us all to say, maybe not just this week, but throughout the series. God made my body and my body is good. Can we all say that together? God made my body and my body is good. I want us to know this in our soul. Christianity says not only did God make our body, but God became like our body. The incarnation, the resurrection, the ascension, they're all affirming the goodness of your body. No matter what's going on, no matter what season of life you're in, God made your body and your body is good. Did you know that when God raised Jesus from the dead, it wasn't a ghost? It was His actual body. It was a physical, the tomb was empty. When God raised Jesus, when Jesus ascended, do you know it's His body that ascended? Right now, this is classic Christian historical theology. Right now, in heaven, there is a human being who's the Son of God in a human body. Heaven and earth have started to come together. So we don't think human beings are just animals, and we don't think human beings are just machines. That's what the Enlightenment said for the last 300 years. Descartes said that we were the ghost in the machine was our soul. We're not just a soul in prison. We are embodied souls and souled bodies. We are both, and God will resurrect your actual body. Because God doesn't give up on what God made and said was good. There are all kinds of implications to this, but what I want you to see today, the most fundamental one, is this. You didn't make your body. You don't sustain your body. And you are dependent on God to resurrect your body. Which means, if you're a baptized believer, you have the Holy Spirit inside you. You are now the temple of the living God everywhere you go. Your body is a gift. It's fundamental to who you are, and it is good. Post-Christian America is so confused right now. And part of the reason is because a lot of you, we go to church. And we listen to messages and Bible classes, and we sing certain songs. And then we go watch Disney or Netflix or Newsmax. And we go have lunch with a coworker, and we hear a very different kind of story. And so what I want to say is, like right now, it's so confusing because it seems like if you believe certain things that Christians have always believed, that people think you hate other people. Christians don't hate anybody. And if you find yourself hating somebody, you're not a Christian yet. That's something we work on, right? And if we're told in our world, in our post-Christian America, that if you have any kind of conviction that certain things are wrong or that some desires are worse than other, then you're a bigot or you hate people. And so I want to say this. The way of Jesus cannot be forced on anybody. I don't do culture wars because Jesus didn't do that. And so if you don't believe God raised Jesus from the dead, I have nothing to say to you. I have nothing to say to you about how you should live. But if you are a follower of Jesus, you don't get to make this stuff up. I think underneath all the culture wars that make this really confusing is this big idea. For conservative people, they think there is no God. So we have to fight to protect our way of life. And for progressives, since there is no God, so there's nobody who should tell me what I can or cannot do. C.S. Lewis said it this way. Writing in post-Christian England, he said, "The Christian and the materialist hold different beliefs about the universe. They can't both be right. The one who is wrong will act in a way which simply doesn't fit the real universe." I think he's right. You have to choose. We live in a world that was built by three men. Seriously, the postmodern, crazy world we live in right now was primarily built by three people. Because philosophers rule the world just 200 years after they die. Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud. And all three, ironically, what was at the heart of their cynicism and suspicion was a doubt and distrust of love. Christian love. Agape. So Marx said, it's not love. It's about money. And Nietzsche said, it's not love, it's about power. And Freud said, it's not about love, it's about sex. And even though most of his arguments have been discredited at this point, he has captured the West imagination, specifically with the more liberation we have sexually, the more health we'll find mentally. Is anybody else seeing the problems with this yet? Freud convinced most people that, and this is what he said, a person is just a machine with satisfaction as its mission. He had enormous influence in persuading the modern world that sexual liberation was the path to mental health. But 60 years into this, and a lot of data coming back, it's not leading us towards mental health. Instead, it's leading us to despair and loneliness and using each other. And the heaviest burdens are falling on the people with the weakest shoulders. Specifically women and children. Christians have always believed the reason that sex is such a strong draw to us is not just because of sex, but because we're reaching for something past it. A story, a greater reality. What you're really reaching for is to know and be known. And even more than that. The great Christian author Philip Yancey says it this way. The very word sex comes from a Latin verb that means to cut off or sever. And sexual impulses drive us to unite, to restore somehow the union that has been severed. Freud diagnosed the deep pain within as a longing for union with a parent. Jung diagnosed a longing for union with the opposite sex. The Christian sees a deeper longing for union with the God who created us. So where did this desire come from? Why does it not just feel carnal? Why does it feel spiritual? In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were made, they were naked and did not shame, but had no shame. And today, we're all naked and feel tons of shame. Even with our clothes off, we're still hiding. I don't know if you know what Nietzsche was most famous for. Anybody know the quote he's most famous for? God is dead. Yeah. Nietzsche didn't say that celebrating that. He said that as a recognition. He lived a couple hundred years ago in Germany, and he was a pastor's kid, which puts a lot of pressure on me and Leslie. Like raising five kids, like, don't mess this up. You don't want our kid running around telling everybody God is dead. Well, Nietzsche looked around the institutions of 18th century Germany, and he saw all these people saying Christian things and acting Christian ways, or saying Christian things and saying that they believe Christian things, but he saw that they didn't live like it. And I don't know if you know this about pastors' kids, but it's true. They can spot hypocrisy from a mile away. And Nietzsche looks at all these institutions, all these churches who are saying what people have always said, but they don't live differently. They don't do anything. They don't really believe it. And so he says out loud for the first time, God is dead. You live like that. You just don't say it with your words yet. And 200 years later, in 1966, when the sexual revolution was getting into full swing, Time magazine realized that what Nietzsche was predicting in the 18th century had now come to pass with things like the Holocaust and the sexual revolution. And so Time magazine in 1966 ran this paper quoting Nietzsche with an article about it, asking, is God dead? And there was one man, a physics professor named Aaron Dicus, who saw this article and went home and wrote a song. It was a poem first, and then it became a song. And it's a very different kind of song than the one you just heard. I'm not important and neither are you, so let us do whatever we want to do. This song says a different story. From dust our God created man. In him we live and we survive. I like to think of these as two different anthems of two different realities. And here's the thing. You can't half believe one and half believe the other. They don't work with each other. Either this life has meaning and your body is good and it matters, or it's not true. Because in the words of that physics professor whose song we're about to sing, our God is alive. And if you believe that, sing it like the anthem it is, because he made this world. He made you, and it is very, very good. Let's stand and sing. There is